taking the liberty this morning of making a change in the topic and the title of the lecture, because as I've been listening to some of you personally, I realize that there are two fears that obviously, as we synergize together, the class is having. One is the deep challenges that we may feel when we're getting down to the roots of our own life do disorientate. And so the purpose really of today is to bring us back onto perhaps a clearer orientation. And the second thing is the sensing that some of you may have that I'm probably being a bit too anti-intellectual or anti-rational. So I think we've had enough of the critiquing of reification. But again, you'll see that it comes through even in this lecture. We can't get away from it. I think is appropriate for us to simply outline what is the nature and purpose of Christian spirituality. And what I'm really doing is to assume that Christian spirituality and spiritual theology really are the same thing. Now, there's also, however, an awareness that the motivation for this interest in spirituality today is multifold. There are many different reasons for it that we can't always put our finger on. But clearly, there is the genuine desire of all Christians at all times to be more authentic, that theory and practice are much more bound together. So clearly that is an ongoing interest that all the traditions of Christian spirituality have had. And yet there's something also distinctive about Christian spirituality today, and that is awareness that is living in the age of postmodernity. It was very helpful last night to hear our lecturer speak on this issue. And as you saw, he was wrestling with two things. Wrestling on the one hand with the dualism that we've inherited in Western thought. And yet on the other hand, the monism as a reaction today that is pagan and not integration. So how does one distinguish between contemporary paganism and at the same time the genuine integration that we want of life and practice, or theory and practice? So what I want to do is to refer you to a book by Thomas C. Oden, O-D-E-N, Agenda for Theology, After Modernity, What? And I think as you read that, you will find a very clear and helpful response by a man who has certainly in the past been looked at as a liberal theologian, and in a sense has now come into the fold, if the fold is evangelicalism. But I think I'm embarrassed, actually, to see the way he's welcomed into the fold. Because evangelicalism has to change in the light of postmodernity, and that's what we're wrestling with. What are the changes that have to come? Let's start then by, in the introduction, looking at what it is that we're seeking in contemporary Christian spirituality, which is, of course, the title of our program. And we hasten immediately to, of course, say that what is contemporary is not Christian spirituality, but the period of culture we're passing through. There's a continuity about truth that is always true, regardless of the culture it belongs to. That it should emphasize certain things may well be a response to the cultural change. So if we're talking about biblical truth, then we're talking about that which is of lasting significance. That it's the unchangeability of God that we are communicating if we're discussing His revelation. But the emphases that we make will change, obviously. And those emphases will relate to the challenges that are thrown up by our time in which we live. So, of course, we are challenged by the worldview, the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. And the spirit of the age today is change. The spirit of the age is discontent with the previous thought patterns, thought forms that we've had. And so one of the things that we recognize is that, therefore, the zeitgeist does throw into doubt the canons of understanding. Understanding is not something that we have automatically to say, oh yes, there always has been understanding, hasn't there? The fact is that understanding is given social sanctions. And I think we've referred to already the fact that clerics in the 18th century who were not prepared to accept the impact of Newtonian physics or the questions in the 19th century of Darwinism or the issues of the nuclear age in the 20th century then are left stranded where people don't find their understanding plausible or convincing because it doesn't come to grips with the questions which are being asked. This, of course, does frighten some people as to whether we're relativizing in the light of change. But there, I hope, we'll see that we've got to guard against that. So one of the things that is already in flux is our definition of what is modern, what is modernity. And so when we look at the history of ideas, we discover that it means a number of things. If we take the French, and here we should have put in the acute accent, so it's la modernité. The French modernité is something between being gauche and conservatively naive, and at the same time being in the swirl of a kind of compulsive up-to-dateness. That we have to be up with it, we would say. But then, when we talk about in intellectual circles what it is to be modern, often the date 1905 is given to us because it was in that year that Virginia Woolf sensitized something happening in Western society. And later, the poet Yeats is to pick it up. What is this thing that is happening after 1905? Well, it's what's happened after 1904. And what happened in 1904 is that we have one of the most profound philosophical shifts that are taken in the modern world in Moore's ethics and his perspective on the philosophy of ethics. And so Moore, M-O-R-E, was the initiator of a movement that was exacerbated, or encouraged at any rate, by the so-called Bloomsbury Circle. These were young avant-garde, literature, artistic types that were really saying that art for art's sake demands a loosening of the moorings of morality. And it's for the sake of art that you, in fact, indulge in both promiscuity and homosexuality, which they indulged in their own circle. The irony is, the tragic irony is, that many members, prominent members of the Bloomsbury Circle, were the great-great-grandchildren of the Clapham sect at the beginning of the 19th century. That is to say that the Wilberforces and the other great leaders like Hannah Moore of social action in an evangelical context that brought significant change in the beginning of the 19th century, had done a whole 360 degree turn in the anti-Christian behavior and thought of the Bloomsbury Circle. So this breaking of moral conventions meant that there was a signaling that life was now boundless, that there were no boundaries, that everything was in flux. Well, that's a second very significant, and it's a historic definition of modern. But there's also a third, and that is the spirit of modernity, which is a spirit of temperament. It's unfair perhaps on the Californians in the audience, but we're talking about these this culture that you are well familiar with, where it is the modo, let's say, what is the latest novelty as the unparalleled virtue. That which is fun is that which is new. And so, of course, we have a whole new consumerism that has grown up around this whole cult of novelty. But going further back in the 18th century literature, there is a new kind of intellectual snobbery that is growing in the 18th century of the obvious advantage of the modern over previous periods. And implicit in this concept of what is modern is this presupposition that is going to intensify of the future as always progress. This optimistic hope in the future is always better. And associated with this then was the cultivation of this modern habit that is in fact xenophobic towards past traditions. Anything that's old-fashioned. It's worse than old-fashionedness because it's really a decrying of the early church fathers. It's a decrying of all the fruits of the Reformation. It's an assumption that we today are much cleverer and smarter than any of our grand or grand-grand-grandparents. And of course, there's a spirit that brought about Bloomsbury versus Clapham in its context. So it's a feeling of the past truth and a worshipping of tomorrow. Well, this, of course, is also associated with really the bankruptcy of this spirit, because its bankruptcy is evidenced in boredom. One of the things that those of us who are in academic life see very clearly is the demoralization that is taking place in academia. To work and study and make your profession in the university today is no longer fun. It's tragic. And so the diversification, the total loss of common communication or common purpose in a university has been lost in all the pluralisms of the multiversity. And so when we read Anthony Bloom's book, we realize that that indictment is an indictment of modernity. So there are really three spheres, and this is where you'll find Thomas Oden's book, After Modernity, What, is very helpful, because he goes on to map out the consequences of these changes. So first, you have this much broader framework of intellectual ideology from the French Revolution until now. The bursting of boundaries didn't take place in 1905. It fundamentally took place in the French Revolution that scared to death all conservatives in Europe. The English particularly were very afraid that they would have on their shores the same revolutionary tidal change. Secondly, there's a mindset of intellectual elites who find previous thought to be irrelevant for further pursuit of scholarship. And this has profoundly affected theological education. And one of the things that is very characteristic of contemporary theological snobbery is that there's no one worth reading for purposes of exegesis prior to Martin Luther. The Middle Ages are bizarre. The early fathers are just not there. And so the instability of liberal theology is really a breaking of the moorings, going adrift with a lack of a historical sense. By the way, one of the other reactions I've had this week is, why is one so fascinated by the past to interpret spirituality? Well, we're going to emphasize that this morning, that we're talking about the roots of our faith. And so cut your roots off, and goodness knows what's going to wilt instead of flower and fructify. So this second mindset is a mindset that's right within the church. It's what is so characteristic of North American Christianity today. The death of the past has taken place in the life of the church. And so the consequence is, thirdly, that there's a third inner core of defining modern. And to define modernity today is to define disease, is to look at something pathological, is to recognize that there has been a profound deterioration. Now, how do we see that deterioration? Well, though it's been happening since the 60s, with all the sickness that we've seen in the attempt to bring in the romanticism of the 19th century in new guise, in moral forms now, in the flower children of the 60s, and the hippie movement, and then the abortive rebellion of students at the end of the 60s on the campuses. That was the beginning, perhaps. But it's since 1984 that we've had a much stronger affirmation of this bankruptcy. In other words, George Orwell has left his mark upon us, 1988. What happens when we've reached that magic year? I remember myself vividly thinking, what's going to happen this year? Especially when you've read the novel. You know? So, after dystopia, what? So, there's a new consciousness among us that since 1984, we're talking about what is postmodern. And, of course, we're talking about the disastrous consequences of our knowledge. That if science and technology are about to bring in the nuclear bomb and the nuclear disintegration of the whole globe, or the environmental crisis is going to bring about even other more radical forms of destruction of our biospheres, then what's gone wrong with knowledge? This is certainly a mark of our time. So it would be a disservice to our understanding of Christian spirituality in its contemporary form if we didn't recognize that always lurking around the corner, really forming a very strong motivation for what we're doing in our understanding of spirituality today, is that we've been highly motivated into this whole enterprise by the bankruptcy of modernity. And I think that really is a much more convincing zeitgeist within which the Christian world today is recognizing what is happening. And so it may be that we suddenly realize that cutting ourselves off from the past, what J.H. Plum, the Cambridge historian, has called the death of the past, is a very serious thing indeed. Because it imprisons us in our own cleverness, which is our own delusion. And that's what modernity has done. If we're cut off from the past, we're cut off from the wisdom of those who invented the wheel long before we needed to think about doing so. So Really, modernity is a futility in reinventing what has long been recognized. The human spirit hasn't changed. Human attitudes have. So what is intrinsically human is much more likely to be learned from the past than at the moment in the present. And one of the tragic consequences of the blindness we were talking about yesterday is fundamentally the blindness of psychology. We'll talk about that this morning. Secular psychology. Because you see, implicit in secular psychology is, of course, these fuddy-duddies of the past knew nothing about all these insights that we have today. And then when we read biographically the life of the saints, we realize they were much more aware of life than we are. And the things that we thought were clarifying, we discover are blinding. So we really do find ourselves standing on our head when we cut ourselves off, as we'll see. So may God grant that there is another Renaissance in the making. Because what was the Renaissance? The Renaissance in Italy was the rediscovery through a renewal of linguistic interest in Greek and Latin that these people had something worth reading. That the classical world did have scholarship and did have philosophy and did have thought that was worth engaging in. And in fact, it revived culture. It didn't destroy culture. It brought culture back into fluorescence. And so it was literally a rebirthing of Western civilization when the Renaissance was discovered. But when you think what that really means, what Renaissance means, it means, in fact, a recovery of roots. Perhaps it was very significant when that film was shown on television some years ago, Roots. It was not only the recovery of one's ancestry, it was a recovery of one's spirit. And since then, there's a whole new industry, of course, in genealogy. The genealogy has developed. The Scots have taken it up with a vengeance, you know. Find out how you related to one of the Macs in the past. And find the appropriate heraldry for it, you see. It's about the first thing you do when you go to Princess Street in Edinburgh. You know, you find out one of the shops that can give you the appropriate tartan for your ancestry. Well, this then is the background. Let's then look then at the historical context of Christian spirituality. The historical context is that we should be content with one word, and that's theology. But in fact, we're not content with it. Some of us have had the presumption to say that spiritual theology is not the same thing as systematic theology. Why do we have to say that? Well, we say that because of what's happened in our Western life. And so the early fathers, like Evagrius Ponticus, who's influenced by Origen, he is saying that theology is prayer and prayer is theology. Well, that certainly wouldn't ring a bell today, but that's the starting point. In other words, when God's prophet says, would to God that all his people were prophets, he's simply telling us that every Christian is a theologian. But he's a theologian not simply looking at things reflectively in theory, descriptively, but he's also essentially a theologian in that he lives as a Christian. And of course, we recognize that what has happened is that this dualism of Western thought has split object from subject and split theory from practice. And so that all these world views, whether they're Ptolemaic, of upstairs and downstairs, the heavenly and the earthly, or the Newtonian, where everything is much more causal and mechanical, or now both of these major cosmological views of life and reality are intrinsically dualistic. And theology suffered in the process. So we may, in fact, describe a first and second level of theology. And we mean by a first level that we are, as all Christians, should be profoundly reflective upon the mystery of God and of his relationship to the created order. Whereas, as a second order, the focus lies more in experiencing God personally. It's a difference between telling somebody else about some person and then having afternoon tea with that person, being in the presence of that person. One is descriptive of an event and the other is the experiencing of the event. So we look back and realize that an awful lot of theology is simply descriptive of talking about God behind his back. And our attitude, our posture, our mindset is very different in the process of doing so. Why do we talk behind God's back? Because so often we have had a low view of the Trinity. The personalness of God hasn't been sharply focused. So we've talked more about the attributes of God, the kind of things that we believe divinity consists of. Abstract, objectifying, but we're not talking about our own experiencing of him. So the dualism too between the transcendence of God and the immanence of God has also heightened this theological embarrassment. And so the split today is intensified because actually in the discipline of theology, you don't ask somebody doing a PhD in theology whether he's a believing Christian. You ask what kind of IQ he's got and what his curriculum vitae has been. And so the split, of course, is intensified by this incredible situation that you have people who may be atheists who are recognized as theologians. How in the world can that be? So that's why spirituality is a protest about all of this. It's crazy. And so we realize that this split, however, is just hasn't happened yesterday. Perhaps one of the most serious stages when the split became obvious is the incipient and then the dominant scholasticism after the 13th century. Towards the end of the Middle Ages then, we find increasingly the need to distinguish what we traditionally call dogmatic theology from moral theology, which was the traditional way of interpreting it in the medieval church. And the Protestant faith, after the impact of the printing press and the importance of Newtonian thought, because there's an increasing development of rationalism, as we've seen with René Descartes and all the input that the new science brought after the 17th and during the 18th century. So that the Protestant world, too, has always made this distinction, traditionally, between systematic theology and ethics. Pastoral theology, but ethics is a broader category of thought to explain the descriptive behavior that is appropriate to living theologically. Now, the dualism within the Catholic Church was intensified through the Middle Ages in terms of Christian living, because you also have two kinds of Christian living. You have the upper deck for the religious. So that those who want the more perfect way, and you notice how even all the Vatican documents of Vatican II still bring in this implicit fundamental dualism of Christian living, that there are two ways of living the Christian life. There's the more perfect and there's the less perfect, basically. Superior and inferior. And the superior is, of course, the conventional or monastic life. Well, what kind of theology do you have for them? Well, that's a super kind of theology. That is called mystical theology. Because these people are mystics, they have extraordinary experiences of God, and they're specializing in those kind of things. So mystical theology is for the elite. Ascetic theology is for you and I who are struggling in the marketplace to do the best we can with our Christian lives. So there, of course, we have disciplines and we want to excel. We know what are the laws of diet and jogging and all the other things that we do for self-enhancement today. And so ascetic theology is helping to be a theological jogger. Well, let's look then at page 2. What then has intensified the split traditionally in the Catholic perspective is that this implicit dualism of living as a Christian spiritually is now intensified both for Catholic and Protestant. You see, Protestants have had the ability to simplify things by abolishing the religious altogether, get rid of the monastic life. So there is, in theory at any rate, though implicitly the professionalism of the Protestant world has brought its own elitism as well. But at least there's a common denominator for describing practical or spiritual theology. But what has intensified the split today is this whole human potential movement. This awareness that there's a great deal more we can do about ourselves. And so, harnessed as it is by contemporary psychology to the whole self-fulfillment movement, it's exaggerated attention on what you and I can do. Even the literature of spiritual disciplines is caught up with this ethos. You know, if you really want to be a more serious Christian, then here are some of the guidelines, and these are some of the techniques, and these are some of the things that you should be doing. So even with the best of intent as Christians, we're being caught up in that framework. You see, this new subjectivity of what I can do, what I want to do, what I want to fulfill in myself, loses sight of what has been the traditional norm of the church. In fact, we can call it the objective norm of the truly integrated life. And that is, I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. That's the antithesis, really. That's the crucification of the human potential movement. There ain't no potential in me. It's dead. And so one of the things that's creating a lot of confusion among present evangelicals is the sudden possibilities of new horizons in spirituality. And it's very difficult to put your finger on what is valid and what is invalid. It is a matter of attitude, a matter of the dispositions of the heart. And so, as I say, even contemporary emphasis upon spiritual disciplines needs critical appraisal in the light of this personal actualization tendency. And so we may validly ask, is this a new form of Pelagianism? A new self-help gospel? And there's also a further danger of spurious spirituality like Gnosticism in the early church. Just what it was in the early church, the new form of Gnosticism is global spirituality. You may find these books, and I find them very helpful. There's a whole series of books on world spirituality that are being edited just now by Crossways, publisher. They eventually will have 25 volumes. They're harnessing over 400 authors. And their intent is to bring about a synthesis or syncretism of all the spiritualities, past and present, of all the religious faiths of the world. including animism, and all the major religions as well. So, living in the global village, this makes sense to modern man, that he should sink his differences and bring about this syncretism. But it's not the first time there's been syncretism. Gnosticism was syncretism. It was a syncretism of Persian and Greek influences. And indeed, behind the Persian, probably Indian influences as well. So, Gnosticism is a human tendency like monism. And in fact, we may say that the two natural tendencies of man are towards pantheism and towards syncretism. Because you can pick and choose in syncretism the things that you like for your diet, you know. It's the smorgasbord of religious life, is syncretism. And the church is in great danger today of syncretism, because many of us are not even members of one church. We're members of several churches. Sunday morning I prefer this kind of service, and Sunday evening I prefer another. Or the mobility that we have, and I'm speaking about myself, I'm not speaking about you, because I have this within me. But it's all part of the fickleness, the pickiness, that the spoilation, the spoilt child of modern man. And so our proclivity towards this is implicit long before we're caught up in doctrinal syncretism. We're caught up in it emotionally, first of all. Another thing that, so there's a danger then, of the human potential movement. There's a danger of syncretism. And then there's also the danger of a kind of issues-orientated spirituality. I haven't made these three very clear, but they stand out when you think about them. And so there are many people today whose definition of the Christian life is, what movement do you belong to? What's the cause of the issue that you are involved with? And you see how this lends itself very closely to functional man. If I define myself by what I do, then where I'm active and what cause I embrace is going to define me as well. And so it's characteristic of liberalism in the Christian life, that when you don't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, then you adopt a cause instead. And of course you justify the cause, because ethically isn't it right that you should? I mean, look at all this injustice. So it's a characteristic of us that in our guilt, we reverse the sense of guilt, we get rid of it by being judgmental of other people. So we look outwardly in order to escape inwardly. Just after I came to Regent, there was a wise businessman here who told me a parable, and I think he was guiding me in the parable. Once upon a time, once upon a time, there was a young white knight who, looking around the world, discovered that everybody around was a black knight. And he wasn't very popular. And so he decided that he would desist from his quest in life to follow the Holy Grail. And instead, he would demolish as many black knights as he could. And he succeeded admirably and survived to a good old age. But one day on the horizon, he did see a young white knight. And gleefully, he rode towards him, only to his dismay to discover the young white knight charged straight at him, pinned him down with his spear, and as he lay dying, he gasped, "Why did you do that for?" And for answer, he showed him his burnished shield, and he saw reflected in it that he had become a black knight. So one of the problems that we have of, I think of one person that I know personally, one of the founders of Oxfam, who was living with a young couple, Christian couple that we knew. And what does he do? He steals a wife. He feeds the hungry in the Sahara, and he destroys the well-being of his neighbor. Now, you say that's an incident. That's not a principle. But that's one of the problems that we find about this whole militancy towards issues in our society. And of course, to take theology and split it up in this kind of issue orientation way, so that we have black spirituality or feminist spirituality or liberation spirituality, you name it, there's always an issue to take up, is of course further obscuring of the true nature of the spiritual life. Another mistaken notion is what we call here psychologism. The temptation to reduce the spiritual life to states of consciousness. We're going to talk more about this. To the production of these states by psychological techniques. Now, you're very prone to this. I'm very prone to this. You only need to go into a Christian bookstore and you say, oh, my prayer life is such a mess. Now, here's a wonderful book that tells you how to do it. And this whole how-to mentality is a harnessing of the self-awareness movement in this technique-orientated society to then thinking that if you've got the right book and the right techniques, you're made. And so there's a profound amount of disillusionment today about people's prayer life because of this very thing. The first lesson in life that we learn is that there are no techniques for being a friend. Try it on your wife. It won't work. And so, even the very soul of the Christian, the very heart of his faith in prayer, is now being subjected to psychologism. Well, these then are some of the things that we face in the challenge of a course like this. What's a solution? I think fundamentally there is only one solution, and that is to go back to the past. Go back to our roots. And so it is in fact one interpretation of what we mean by spirituality, and that is that we are radical enough to go back to our past. The prodigal son was radical in his spirituality because he remembered his father's house. He remembered where he came from. And we've lost that. Thomas Oden starts his book with a very arresting parable. It's the parable of a plumber magnate. He's now become a very wealthy businessman, but basically he's a plumber. And he's inherited an old crown of jewels. But the style, the ornateness, the features of this crown are very quaint, and he doesn't even know whether there are jewels. They might just be bits of colored black glass. He probably thinks that's all they are. And so he has this crown thrown up over the antlers of a hunting stag that he has in his lounge. And there have been times when he's tossed it around and decided that perhaps he could take one of the stones, and hopefully it is a jewel, so he'll pawn it and see what he gets for it. But he does fortunately have a son who thinks differently. He's fascinated by this crown. And while it's quite true it's out of this world, it doesn't represent anything of normal dress or normal value, yet he has within him a profound intuition that this is priceless. And so what Auden is saying is that's how we have reacted to our Christian tradition. And it's only when we begin to take seriously Augustine or Bernard or Jonathan Edwards, John Calvin, in the classics of faith that they write about, and in spite of their language and their archaisms, to penetrate through that to the marrow of what they're articulating, we suddenly discover we've got the crown jewels in our lounge and we didn't know it. So basically, one of the elements of spirituality today is the recovery of the crown jewels, for which previous generations fought and died for the privilege of even looking at them, let alone possessing them. But often, there was a feeling that corporately, this was not a private possession anyway. It belonged to the whole society. And they were prepared to fight to their death for its protection. So this then is one of the things that we need to think about, that spirituality has this dual aspect to it. One aspect is therefore rejoicing in the communion of saints, being enriched by the communion of saints. And the other, of course, is in the communion of saints getting back to our own roots so that we know our ancestry. An ancestry, hopefully, that is an Abel, not Cain, that is an Abraham, not in Lot, that is in Jacob, not Esau, that is in David, not Saul. And so the collective wisdom of generations is, of course, itself expressed in the canonicity of Scripture.